So Acts 26, verses 24 to 32 is our passage this morning. And Paul then is addressing this august audience in Caesarea. Roman military tribunes are there. Prominent men of the city are there. The Roman governor Porcius Festus is there. King Agrippa and his sister Bernice are there. And it's an interesting address then which Paul delivers. We saw last week that you can clearly perceive in it a certain moment where the tone changes markedly. That moment is in verse 8. I called it last week Paul's Martin Luther King moment. Because just as Martin Luther King, a few minutes into his famous speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, suddenly abandoned his script and became much more free and raw as he launched into that I have a dream material, so Paul in verse 8 abandons his legal defense with all its detailed technical jargon that he's been coming out with in the opening verses, and he becomes much more free and much more raw. And this morning then, we're at the end of this address, and here that freedom, that emotional intensity that kicked in at verse 8, it really reaches its climax, and it produces, I would suggest, one of the great statements of the book of Acts, the statement recorded in verse 29, whether short or long, I would to God that not only you, but also all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except for these chains. And our approach then to this passage this morning is going to be to center on that statement, and I would like us to notice then three things. First of all, the setting. The setting. Now, I've already reminded you in just a moment of the general setting. We don't need to say anything more about that, that Paul is addressing this audience in Caesarea. But it's the more specific setting then that I want you to notice at this point, what immediately precedes verse 29. So in verse 24, you'll notice Paul is interrupted. He's interrupted by the governor Festus, who kind of pays Paul a backhanded compliment, because he refers, doesn't he, to Paul's great learning. So he's not suggesting that Paul is a numpty, that he's an ignoramus, that he's an intellectual charlatan. No, he acknowledges that Paul is studious and erudite, but the compliment is very backhanded. Because his real intention is not actually to praise Paul as a scholar, his real intention is to dismiss Paul as a scholar whose obsessive academic pursuits have tipped him over the edge. You're out of your mind, he shouts at him. You're off your rocker, Paul. You've lost the plot. You're stark, raving bonkers. That's the real point of the governor's interruption. And it elicits then from Paul that firm denial in verse 25. I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I am speaking true and rational words. And it's interesting that both Festus in verse 24 and Paul in verse 25 use a Greek word for being out of one's mind that is very closely related to a word Paul has already used back in verse 11. Which in the ESV is translated fury, in raging fury against them, Paul says back there. And it's a very similar word, just the prefix is slightly different, but very similar word. And so you see what's going on here then. Here's Paul. And in verses 9 to 11, earlier on in the speech, he describes this time in the past when he had been a madman. He'd been driven by mindless, irrational fury, he says. He'd been putting innocent people in prison. He'd been trying to get them to say things against their will. He'd been participating in their executions. He'd been traveling to foreign cities to do the same thing there. But then, in verses 12 to 15, he describes how he was converted at a certain point to Christianity. And then in verses 16 to 23, he describes his subsequent life after that conversion experience, this life of sanity, exchanging the sword for the lectern, brutal executions for biblical expositions, going around preaching about repentance and forgiveness and resurrection. And so that contrast then between Paul, the persecuting madman then, and Paul, the same preacher now, just seems so blindingly obvious, doesn't it? It seems utterly unmistakable, as easy to distinguish as Mr. Hyde is from Dr. Jekyll. But it's not obvious and unmistakable to Festus. No, for Festus, it isn't Paul back then, it isn't Paul the fevered persecutor who is out of his mind. No, for Festus, it's Paul now. It's Paul the gentle preacher who is out of his mind. And you know, that topsy-turvy perspective then that we see in Festus here, it's not uncommon, is it? So there's a student and she becomes a Christian. And from that point, her Friday night routine changes quite considerably. She no longer goes from club to club, consuming more and more alcohol until she's blind drunk. She prefers other activities now. What's the verdict then of her flatmates on all that, as they head off for the bars without her? Oh, she's gone a bit strange. That's what they say. Think about that. On a Friday night, her speech is no longer hopelessly slurred. She doesn't suddenly lurch into the road when she's walking along the pavement. She doesn't embarrass herself because she's lost all her inhibitions. She doesn't end up lying on a freezing cold street in a pool of vomit. And they say that's her gone a bit strange. Or there's a doctor and he becomes a Christian, and soon after he exercises his legal right to conscientious objection when it comes to involvement in abortions. And what's the verdict of some of his colleagues on all of that? Oh, he's gone a bit strange, they say. Again, think of that. He will play no further part in destroying life. No longer devote his working hours to undoing conceptions, terminating pregnancies. His medical expertise will now be used solely for remedial, health-giving, life-preserving purposes. And they say that's him gone a bit strange. But we shouldn't be surprised. It's what we see in the Bible. It's what we see in Acts 26. Here's Festus, and it's the new, improved, non-violent, non-persecuting, reasonable Paul that he considers out of his mind, off his head, mad. But notice then that Paul, while he does offer that rebuttal in verse 25 that I've already quoted, he doesn't linger, does he, over Festus's interruption. In fact, he doesn't seem to be overly interested in Festus. He seems to have his sights set on someone else here, and that someone else is King Agrippa. And in verse 26, then, he indicates that he's now going to speak very, very particularly to Agrippa, and he also indicates there that he's going to speak to Agrippa boldly. That's the word he uses. And I think we need to appreciate just how bold his ensuing words to Agrippa are. Let's jump for a moment to Agrippa's response to Paul in verse 28. Now, it's not the easiest sentence to translate in the Greek, but I think the most tenable translation is not quite what we have in the ESV, but is something like this. Agrippa says, "Are you trying to convince me that in a short time you have made me a Christian?" That, I think, is the best way of translating it. Are you trying to convince me that in a short time you have made me a Christian? Now, if that's correct, that's interesting, isn't it? So Agrippa then doesn't think that Paul is trying to make him a Christian. No, Agrippa thinks Paul is trying to convince him he is a Christian. That's what he seems to be saying. Now, why would Agrippa think that? Well, he would think that because of Paul's words in verses 26 and 27. Look at what Paul says there at the end of verse 27. "I know that you believe." That's an extraordinary comment, isn't it? "I know that you believe." And we mustn't play that down and say, "Oh, he's only talking about believing the prophets." And believing the prophets isn't that big a deal. Well, actually, believing the prophets is that big a deal, isn't it? Remember Jesus' words to two disciples on the road to Emmaus following his resurrection. And remember how he condemns them, "Oh, foolish ones and slow of heart, to believe all that the prophets have spoken." Luke 24:25. Think of Paul writing to the Corinthians and describing the condition of first century Jews generally. He says, "Whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their hearts." 2 Corinthians 3:15. But Paul doesn't say to Agrippa, "How slow of heart you are, Agrippa, to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Oh, Agrippa, there's a veil that's lying over your heart whenever you read the Old Testament." That's not what he says to Agrippa. To Agrippa he says, "I know that you believe." And he specifies that it's in connection with him noticing the death and resurrection of Jesus. And he says, doesn't he, that "I'm persuaded none of these things have escaped his notice." None of what things? Well, the death and resurrection of Jesus that Paul has been talking about in the preceding address. It's in connection with Agrippa having noticed, taken note of the death and resurrection of Jesus that he believes. This is extraordinary, what Paul is saying of Agrippa. Why does he say that? Why does he essentially say, "Agrippa, you're a Christian. I know that you believe"? Well, presumably, he thinks that Agrippa may have come to faith while he's been listening to this address in that hall in Caesarea. Remember, we said a couple of weeks ago that Agrippa volunteered to hear Paul on this occasion. We mustn't think that it was Festus's idea, because Festus needed something to write to Caesar, and so Festus then said to Agrippa, "Agrippa, will you come along and listen so that you can help me write something?" No, that idea of Festus's came after. Agrippa volunteered first, "I want to hear Paul." And perhaps Paul knows that. Paul knows that Agrippa has volunteered to hear him here. And perhaps he feels then that there's already a serious interest residing within Agrippa that might just have developed now into actual faith as he's been listening to this address. And presumably Paul also thinks that saying very directly like this, "I know that you believe," that will prove a useful litmus test. And Agrippa's reaction to those words will reveal whether, in fact, he has come to faith or not. And so I'm saying then that this very forward approach of Paul here, it's an evangelistic tactic that he employs on this occasion. I'm not sure we see him ever employing it on another occasion. And it may not be a tactic that is ever called for by any of the situations that we find ourselves in. In some cases, saying to someone, "I know that you believe, I think you're a Christian," that might be quite inappropriate because the person is quite obviously nowhere near becoming a Christian yet. hypocrites. In some cases, it might be counterproductive because the person wrongly thinks that they are a Christian and they need to be disabused of that idea, not confirmed in that idea. So it's a very case-specific evangelistic tactic that Paul uses here. It's not necessarily prescriptive for us this morning, but it does remind us, doesn't it, that part of the beauty of Christian evangelism is that there's no fixed formula. There's no one way of always doing it. A friend of mine was originally from the Outer Hebrides, and he grew up and wasn't a Christian, but then at a certain point in his adult life he became very troubled about things and started to read a Bible. And on one occasion then he was in Perth, and he just couldn't go on anymore like this. And so he found out the phone number of a local minister, and he rang him and he said, "Look, I'm not a Christian, but I feel I just need to talk to you." And so the minister invited him round to the manse, and he went round there, and he was ushered into the study. And the minister said to him right away, "Right, the first thing we're going to do is this, we're going to pray. I'll pray first, and then you'll pray after that." Well, this completely freaked out my friend. He'd possibly never prayed in his life before. He had certainly never prayed in front of anyone else before. What would he say? What would this minister think of his prayer? All this was going through his head. And when then the minister finished praying, he actually cleverly got round that situation by praying in Gaelic, his native tongue, so that the minister couldn't understand what he was saying anyway. But in that Gaelic prayer, he basically cried out to God to save him. And my friend says now that God heard that prayer, because by the time he walked out of that study, he was a believer in Jesus Christ. But what a strange approach by that minister. This troubled, unbelieving soul coming to see him. And he doesn't begin by trying to answer his questions. He doesn't begin by taking him to some gospel texts in the New Testament. No, he says, "Look, we're going to pray. Me first, then you." Would you have done that? Would that have been your approach in that situation? Probably not. Would you find that in any evangelism textbook? Probably not. But Christian evangelism, then, it isn't like the recruitment drives of the cults that come to your doorstep. It doesn't conform rigidly to the contents of any textbook. No, it's idiosyncratic, and I'm saying that's actually part of the beauty of it, isn't it? So that's the setting that we've noticed, first of all. But let's move on, secondly, to the statement, then. The statement. So we've said that Paul must have felt that this line, "I know that you believe," he must have felt that that would reveal decisively where Agrippa was. His reaction to those words would show him to be either a new convert, as Paul perhaps suspected, or, in fact, nothing of the sort. And sadly, then, it's the latter, isn't it, that transpires. His reaction shows that he is nothing of the sort. "Are you trying to convince me that in a short time you have made me a Christian?" It's clearly a hostile reaction. It's what the Americans would call a pushback. He's making it clear in no uncertain terms that he's repelling Paul, repelling Paul's advances. And it's in response to that, then, that Paul makes this statement in verse 29 that I bigged up so much in my introduction a few minutes ago. We've considered its setting, now we must consider the statement itself. And it seems to me, then, that in this statement, Paul is correcting three misconceptions evident within Agrippa's pushback. Three misconceptions regarding conversion. So misconception number one, then: conversion is unvarying. Conversion is unvarying. Because it's interesting, isn't it, that Agrippa does highlight this business of a short time. Are you trying to convince me that in a short time you've made me a Christian? He doesn't rule out altogether the possibility that Paul might make him a Christian, but in a short time, in just 20 minutes, half an hour, however long it's taken to give this speech, you think I could have become a Christian in that length of time? The births of our children were all fairly complicated, and sometimes then when I meet someone and they tell me, oh, my wife's just had a baby, often I'll say something like, well, you know, how long did your wife stay in hospital, or something like that. And sometimes I'll say, well, she came out the same day, or didn't even go into hospital in the first place. And I can't get my head around that, because it just seems to me that, you know, when you have a baby, it's complicated and you're in hospital for quite a while. This unvarying model of childbirth. And Agrippa then seems to have this unvarying model of what it means to convert to Christianity. Where he's got that from, we don't know. Perhaps he's thinking in terms of all sorts of initiation rites that would need to take place. We don't know what's in his mind, but he seems to rule out the possibility of becoming a Christian in 20 minutes, in half an hour. No, some long process would have to be involved in me becoming a Christian. And Paul then is correcting that misconception, first of all, because he says, doesn't he, short or long, whether short or long, it doesn't make any difference. Paul is saying, no, it might be a long process, like you're thinking, Agrippa. It might be very short. That's irrelevant. There's no unvarying model of conversion. It doesn't matter how long it takes. That's what Paul is saying at the start there of his statement in verse 29. And I think that's instructive for us then, Paul's correction of that misconception. Perhaps for us, reared as many of us evangelicals have been on testimonies which talk about kind of being converted suddenly one night at an evangelistic crusade or whatever, perhaps we have the opposite model in our heads from Agrippa. Agrippa thinks, oh, it has to be an awfully long process. We might think that it always just takes place like that. And remember, we saw back in chapter 17 of Acts that fascinating comment by Luke about the people in Athens who joined Paul and then believed. And we said that it was almost that they subscribed to Paul's worldview, first of all, that theistic worldview, and then later they actually trusted in Jesus Christ. And there was obviously a process, probably quite a lengthy, protracted process involved. And we need perhaps to get that into our heads, particularly in our increasingly post-Christian culture, that often conversion will be a long process, months, perhaps years, perhaps decades. But the more important point is that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether short or long, Paul says. And we need to get out of our heads this idea that every conversion fits into a certain mold. Yes, of course, in conversion there is always the Holy Spirit applying to a person the benefits secured by Jesus Christ at the cross of Calvary, and so on. There is that uniformity, but in terms of the outward circumstances, in terms of how it actually plays out, it can be, one conversion can be very different from another. And we can easily then, if we have an idea that the model is unvarying, and mine doesn't quite fit that can trouble us, and we can have problems of assurance, or perhaps I'm not a proper Christian because my testimony, my conversion narrative isn't quite the same as that one I've just heard that person give at the front of this meeting or whatever. And so we need to have it in our heads that conversions happen in all kinds of ways, and they're still genuine conversions. That's the first misconception Agrippa has. Conversion is unvarying. Misconception number two, conversion is unremarkable. Conversion is unremarkable because whose agency does he seem to see in conversion? Are you trying to convince me that in a short time you have made me a Christian. He thinks it's about Paul making him a Christian through his preaching, through his arguments, through his persuasion. He thinks that's how people become Christians, through the brilliance of the evangelist, the preacher. And Paul corrects that as well, doesn't he? Because, unfortunately, it doesn't come across very well at all in ESV here, but when he says, I would to God, we actually have the verb pray there, the normal New Testament verb for pray. And, okay, he doesn't say, I am praying that, ... and that's why the ESV, I think, tries to get across something of the rhetorical flourish that Paul uses. He uses a strange tense of the word pray, but that's the verb he uses. He's basically saying something like, I would pray to God, or my prayer to God would be, something like that would be the most accurate translation. But the point is then, he's saying that actually God is the one. By talking about prayer and asking God for conversions, he's saying God is the converter. He's correcting Agrippa's misconception that Paul converts people. No, God is the converter. I pray to God that you and everyone else here might become like I am. And that's basic, isn't it? We all know this morning. But again, it's something we can't be reminded of too often, that God is the one who converts. You see, it's why Paul can have this remarkable expectation here that Agrippa has become a Christian. Okay, in this case, he's wrong. Certainly at this point, perhaps Agrippa does later on, who knows, but he's wrong on this occasion. But you think, well, why on earth did Paul ever entertain the idea that Agrippa would become a Christian? I mean, this man who's in the Herod dynasty, this man who we said a couple of weeks ago is quite possibly in an incestuous relationship with his sister. This man, he just seems a million miles away from becoming a Christian. How could Paul ever have thought that he would become a Christian? Well, this is how, because Paul knows that God is the converter of people. The same God he's talked about in verse 8. Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead? God was the raiser of Jesus from the dead, and a God who can raise a dead person who's in a tomb outside of Jerusalem, been there for 3 days, a God who can do that, well, he can certainly raise to new life of a different kind King Agrippa. And anybody else he so pleases to do. And we need to be clear on this, don't we? As we look out at people we know, and we just find it hard to envisage them possibly ever being Christians, and we think, well, there's no point then. No point in telling them the gospel. Of course there's point. If it was us making them Christians, no point at all. But if it's God, the God who raised Jesus from the dead, then of course those people can become Christians. Conversion isn't this unremarkable human thing where arguments either persuade or don't persuade. No, conversion is this remarkable thing where God irresistibly grips a person and changes them forever. Conversion is unvarying, conversion is unremarkable. Misconception number 3, conversion is undesirable. Conversion is undesirable. Because it's interesting, he says, are you trying to convince me that in a short time you have made me a Christian? Only the second time we have this word Christian used in Acts. And of course, Christian, remember, it's originated in Antioch, not as a self-designation by the Christians, but as a label by those outside, and probably therefore a mocking label, a kind of nickname. Well, they're always on about Christ, these Christians. That's probably how it originated, and that's probably how Agrippa is using it here. He's saying it in a sneering tone. If he'd said, are you trying to convince me that in a short time you've made me a believer in Jesus Christ, that might have been different, but a Christian. he's the tone is something like, why on earth would I who am sitting here in all this pomp, as Luke has described it in 25 verse 23, I who have so many privileges, so much kudos, so much status, why would I want to become a Christian, a Christ one, a Christ person? Why would I want to do that? There's a sneering tone probably in what he says here. And Paul then corrects that misconception too, doesn't he? When he says that, I pray to God that not only you but also all who hear me this day might become such as I am. So there are all those dignitaries sitting there in their pomp, their fine robes, their jewelry, just everything about them screaming out splendor, pomp, grandeur. Here's Paul, probably dressed very shabbily, an unimpressive looking figure. And Paul is not saying, oh, I wish I was like you guys. He's saying, I wish all you were like me, because I have Jesus, and I'd rather have Jesus than anything, because it's better. It's better to have what I've got than what you've got. Conversion isn't this undesirable thing because you just become one of those Christians. It's this most amazing thing. You're getting Jesus, and I wouldn't exchange it for the pomp and glory of all of you lot in this room in Caesarea. That's what Paul is saying. It's the best possible existence. I wonder, have you kind of lost sight of that, have forgotten that? The busyness, the pressures, the difficulties of life. Yes, you still know you're a Christian, and yeah, you still know that one day there's going to be heaven and that'll be great and all the rest of it, but you've lost this sense of, I wouldn't give away this for anything that anybody else has. I wouldn't swap it for the whole world. I wouldn't swap it for the fortunes of any Premier League footballer, for the fame of any pop star. I wouldn't swap it for anything. This is the best. What I've got is the best. Absolutely. I have Jesus, and I'd rather have Jesus than anything. He's realistic, isn't he? He does add, except for these chains. He doesn't try and give the impression to Agrippa, if you become a Christian, then suddenly life will be easy. And there'll be no more problems, no more difficulties. No, he's quite realistic that being a Christian can involve chains, and chains are bad. He says, I wouldn't wish these on any of you. It's interesting, isn't it, this biblical perspective. I've talked about it before on suffering. How there's this kind of tension, isn't there, that suffering is both inherently wrong because it's a result of the curse, it's a result of sin, and yet it's providentially right because God has given me this particular suffering for my good. And Paul then, he can move between those two extremes, and often, of course, he will talk about suffering being for his good. I delight in my weaknesses, 2 Corinthians, he'll say often. But here it's the other side of the tension. I wouldn't wish these chains on any of you. These are horrible. That's what he's saying. There's that realism there. But nonetheless, having Christ, I have something that's better than anything all of you sitting in those thrones have yourselves. So we've seen then the setting, the statement, but just very briefly as we close, let's notice the sequel. The sequel. Because the passage continues then in verse 30, and it shows us Agrippa and Festus having a conversation after this address that Paul has given. And it's very striking, isn't it, just the business-likeness of this address. It's so business-like. They're just now two statesmen, two politicians talking about this case and what they're going to do with Paul, and what a shame that he's applied to Caesar and all the rest of it. And it's like they've just kind of completely drawn a line under this powerful, challenging address that Paul has just given. And perhaps I'm reading too much into it, one doesn't want to do that, but you can't help feeling that for Agrippa then, at least, there is a certain amount of evasion involved in that. That he has been challenged. He has felt the challenge of Paul's words. And it's made him uncomfortable and it's made him squirm. And his way of dealing with that is just kind of reverting to business and talking about just the legal processes and administrative matters, bureaucratic issues. That's how he evades the challenge of Paul's words. I think that can often happen. Some of you will have read C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters. It's always a bit risky quoting from The Screwtape Letters because it's kind of does your head in a bit listening to it, of course, because you've got to remember it's a devil writing to another devil, and so you've got to kind of take it and process it when you hear Screwtape Letters quoted. But in one of this devil's letters to the other devil, then he says this. He says, I once had a patient, a sound atheist, who used to read in the British Museum. One day as he sat reading, I saw a train of thought in his mind beginning to go the wrong way. In other words, he saw this man, this atheist, starting to think about God and starting to think about Christianity. And he says, and if I had lost my head and begun to attempt a defense by argument, I should have been undone, but I was not such a fool. I struck instantly at the part of the man which I had best under my control and suggested that it was just about time he had some lunch. By the time I'd added, much better come back after lunch and go into it with a fresh mind. He was already halfway to the door. Once he was in the street, the battle was won. I showed him a newsboy shouting the midday paper and a number 73 bus going past. And before he reached the bottom of the steps, I had got into him an unalterable conviction that whatever odd ideas might come into a man's head when he was shut up alone with his books, a healthy dose of real life, by which he meant the bus and the newsboy, was enough to show him that all that sort of thing just couldn't be true. And so often, real life, in inverted commas, can be used to douse, to extinguish the challenge of the Word of God. Don't let that happen this morning. Perhaps this morning you've been challenged by something we've sung in a hymn, something in a prayer, something in this sermon. Challenged, think perhaps I do need to know Jesus Christ. Perhaps I need to make my peace with God through Jesus Christ. Perhaps I need a Saviour. The danger is you'll go out and there'll be a number 73 bus, there'll be a newsboy, and real life will suddenly make you think, ah, well, I was a bit excessive in my reaction sitting in that chair a few minutes ago. Don't let that happen. Don't revert to business, to normality, but deal with these things and come to Jesus Christ while the matter is pressing on your mind. May God help us all. Amen.